Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
They are liars. They fabricate the facts when the facts don't fit their narrative. And that is why people are pushing back. That is why his numbers are in the potty. It is why.
Oh, that was precious.
They are rejecting Elon Musk and his Doge bags, and it's just it's like enough's enough, and so people are saying, we just want you, government, to focus on making our lives more affordable, which is what Democrats are going to continue to fight to make sure they know we have their back.
Hey, folks, welcome again to the Michael Steele podcast. Now, before y'all get yourselves all riled up, you need to go get something and settle down, right? And that's what we want to do. We want to settle down and have a conversation with a member of Congress, which we get to do with my friend, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of the great state of Florida. She represents its 25th congressional district. She's the first Jewish woman elected to Congress from Florida. She has spent nearly 3 decades fighting for seniors, children, working families, communities, both in her district and outside of her district. She's also been, as you probably know, a strong advocate for women's rights and a leading voice in protecting Social Security and Medicare, expanding access to health care. She and I had a dance back in the day when I was RNC chairman over Obamacare. So that's how that goes. But she's good people. And she's been a good congresswoman, sort of an advocate for the folks that she represents, whether it's on health care, reducing gun violence, promoting equity under the law. She was also chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee from 2011 to 2016. So it's a real pleasure to welcome to the mic my friend and former colleague in the political space, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, right after this. Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Excited to have you here. I'm excited to have a compadre, a soldier in the battle of American politics, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's a congresswoman, a former DNC chairwoman, which, you know, I have a particular affinity for that role that you played, congresswoman. Good to see you, Deb.
Good to see you, too. So good to be with you.
When you were running the DNC, and we would occasionally see each other, it was always that moment when you walk into the green room or where we happen to be, and we both have that same look that all chairmen get, like, okay, what's going on here?
Very small siblinghood, for lack of a better term, and it's like even smaller than, like, the member of Congress world. Really, only we know what, not the officers of the DNC, only former chairs of national parties understand.
They get it. We get it. That's exactly right. It is a unique club indeed.
Gratifying role.
Yes.
Most of the time.
You know, so from that standpoint, how do you today look at, because you unlike most of your members, as you were just noting, you have a very unique perspective, not just on the policy piece, which is obviously, you know, what you are engaged in as a member of Congress, but also the political piece, how those things align, sometimes intersect, conflict. You appreciate more than anything the power of messaging for your party, why that may or may not have worked to the degree it should have in the 2024 cycle. So when you're stepping back down, looking at, before we get to the 100 days of Trump, looking at the transition of the Biden team from Biden to Kamala, Kamala's race for during 107 days. What about that sort of informs how you look at this moment now in terms of what you tell your colleagues? Okay, guys, this is the lesson we should have learned. This is the lesson we need to learn. And these are the things we need to do.
Well, Michael, I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk more extensively rather than in, you know, quick snippets like interviews usually are on TV. The best way to answer your question is that I literally just stepped out of Hakeem Jeffries, our Democratic leader's address to the nation about Trump's 100 days. And his singular focus, which is really what we're laser focused on as Democrats, and really as Americans across the country are reeling from the onslaught that's coming out of the Trump administration that impacts their bottom line every day. And so what the leader talked about was so critical. That we will be relentlessly focused on what Trump, you know, said he was going to make a priority, but instead has actually done the exact opposite, and that is make sure that we stand up to protect and improve people's bottom line, their everyday affordability. The fact that Trump is coming after Social Security clearly with the intention of heading towards privatization, trying to break it from the inside, through the back door, so that they can eventually say, see, Social Security doesn't work. And so we're going to have to just do something different, which in their mind, for all the years I've been here, has meant privatization. And, you know, there's so much quote unquote, according to them, because that's the messaging that works well for them, waste, fraud, and abuse.
Right.
No evidence for. So they're cutting Medicaid, cutting SNAP, you know, the nutrition lifeline for millions of Americans. And what Democrats are focused on, and Leader Jeffries talked about this, is making sure that every day, relentlessly, we both in policy, in word and deed, and policy, that we fight to make sure that we can reduce people's costs, make life more affordable, and ensure that their earned benefits, you know, not an entitlement, but their earned benefits, Social Security and Medicare, and, you know, and then Medicaid, which is a lifeline for tens of millions of Americans, that we can't let them, you know, yank that out from away from people and leave them without health care and twisting in the wind, trying to just figure out how to make it.
How do you balance? Because in listening to you, I really can see the narration on of what you're talking about and sort of really sort of settling in on that, on the economic impact that people are just now beginning to feel. I've been saying for about a month now, as everyone is dancing around, and again, with the numbers that were released today on the contraction in our economy because of Donald Trump. Let's be clear, America, this is not Joe Biden. Donald Trump is out here sending out tweets talking about, oh, this is the Biden, you know, overhang. I don't know what the hell that is. And maybe he meant hangover, but anyway. He doesn't know. He's just tweeting as what, you know, 80-year-old men do.
We had the strongest economy in the world when at the end of Joe Biden's presidency.
Thank you. Post-COVID, so now we're sitting here. watching the lifeblood suck out of the economy. Yes. And so I think as Hakeem Jeffries and the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House and Senate for sure, but then even out around the country, when you see the conversation that your colleague, Ocasio-Cortez is doing, as well as Bernie Sanders, you have this sort of interesting narrative around the economy. But then there's this other piece. And I'm wondering how you sort of integrated into the conversation around the Constitution, democracy, due process, when we watch people being snatched up and sent away without any hearings, without any ability to say, hey, wait a minute, you got the wrong guy. How do you see those two narratives coming together, or are they on separate tracks? Do people care more about the economy than they do about due process?
Well, I mean, if you look at the polling that has been done, whether it's individual polling in various regions across the country, or in individual campaigns, or even, news organizations, people are deeply concerned about the erosion of our democracy and what and the acts that Trump is taking to our democracy, and what that means, in granular terms, for most people is they're appalled. Even if they think that someone eventually should be deported, right, and that they support the idea that if you're not supposed to be here in the country, particularly if you've committed a crime, that you should be deported. But that we are entitled to present evidence in mm-hmm. in a legal proceeding, whether it's an immigration proceeding or a court of law, when you are accused of something, or when you are going to have a consequence in this country. In this country, we do not, spirit people away. We don't disappear people to El Salvador with grabbing them in the night. And I don't want to use the term due process, because there's a lot of folks that don't even really know what that means. Right. Or the component parts of it, which is you get to understand what charges are being brought against you. You get to understand what evidence they have. You get to defend yourself and present a case. And then a decision is rendered and justice is meted out, and a consequence or an action or you get to, in a case of an immigration case, you get to remain. But when you have hundreds of Venezuelans who were disappeared to a prison, the worst of the worst prisons in El Salvador, through a deal that Trump cut with their dictator, mm-hmm. That's the most un-American of actions. And, people find that despicable. And then you layer on top of the fact that he has levied these tariff taxes
right.
across the board. Really, he's engaged in a trade war with multiple countries, and it's jacking up people's costs. I'll just give you an example. I just grabbed lunch before that I didn't get to eat yet, but. So I'm looking forward to that. But that the lunch that I grabbed in one of the congressional cafeterias was $2 more than it was just a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. We have
now already.
I have been going to that cafeteria, getting the exact same thing nearly every day when I'm up here, and it is $2 more. Now, there's a reason for that. They didn't just randomly in April decide to raise their prices.
Right.
They raised their prices because you have wholesalers whose costs have increased because of what they are being charged themselves as a result of tariffs being added on top of the goods that they are bringing in.
Congressman, we'll talk about that a little bit, because I think people are starting to be to appreciate what you just said. And there are, again, there's a process here. Everything sort of flows down, but everything takes time. There are, leading indicators of what's about to hit you, right? Right. With these tariffs. But I think people are now trying to figure out, what their price situation is. The fact that shelves potentially, I mean, there are a lot of things that have been pre-ordered, right?
Folks have loaded in the first quarter.
Up their inventory, you know, sort of. But even that has a limitation because as a small business owner, I only have so much room to store my goods to sell to you. So at some point, I'm going to run out of what I do have on my shelves because the ships are sitting off in the middle of some ocean or not even coming at all.
Right.
So the supply chain is impacted. The price that I'm paying now with 150% tariff on China is tax. And I'm actually moving out of calling it a tariff and calling it what it is. It is a tax.
Yeah,
I'm using tax.
Yeah,
on people. Mm-hmm. So talk people through a little bit of that. You see this in your state of Florida as a big economic engine, also a crossroads on the subject of immigration, the impact that this has there as folks are being snatched up and are being afraid of being snatched up, they don't go to work.
Right. They
don't go to work. And so stuff ain't getting done.
Yep.
So it may not even matter how much inventory you have because you don't have employees who are going to sell and process that inventory because they're afraid the government's going to snatch them and take them away.
I already have employers who are saying that there are employees that previously worked for them that are not showing up to work anymore. And look, with the prices, with Trump's tariff taxes, which is, you're exactly right, that's what they are. It's an added tax, you know, onto the bottom line of what something costs you. With those tariff taxes, you know, there's a pain point on a lot of items past which the average consumer, you know, the average person is just going to say, you know what, I have to give that up. So, I mean, my lunch that I purchase every day, you know, for myself here in DC, it's $2 more. You know, for the folks who have a limited income, you know, what that means is that they're either going to maybe not eat lunch or they're going to not be able to buy lunch at the local cafe that they usually pick it up from. And so the customer base declines. People aren't showing up to work to actually help serve the food. And it becomes this vicious cycle, downward spiral. And that's what's headlonging us into a recession. And then on top of that, the uncertainty, because he's not even engaged in a rational trade policy.
Mm-hmm.
Every other day, there's some other chyron across the bottom of a TV screen on the news on what he's pulling back on, what he's adding, how much he's adding. All the business owners that I know and that I speak to in my district, they need certainty in order to be able to make sure that they can plan effectively for what their bottom line is going to be so that they can stay in business, make a profit, which most of their profit margin is very small.
I mean, right.
This is devastating stuff to small businesses, which is, you know, most the backbone of our economy are our small businesses. 80% of businesses are characterized in this country as small, and he's devastating them.
You know, it's interesting as you look at the landscape right now, everyone's kind of wondering, okay, so how do people really feel? What are they thinking? Well, the polling that's coming out as we look at the first 100 days, if I'm the White House, in the White House right now, I'm in the Oval with the president going, dude, you need to think about this, because right now 41% of the American people approve of what the president has done over his first 100 days. That's the lowest. What was that?
This is the president who has the worst approval rating, the worst numbers in 80 years.
80 years. And mm-hmm. And when you look at that, when you look at the, you know, an issue about the handling of the job, just 22% of the American people look at him as president and say, I like that. Mm-hmm. That for me, from a political standpoint, is a huge opening. With elections coming up this November in Virginia and New Jersey, which are the proving grounds for the next cycle in 26. I know that well because in 09, it was the proving ground for what I would need to do in 2010 to be right. successful. And so I had to win the governorships in those two jurisdictions, particularly New Jersey, which, like Maryland, leaned more Democratic at that time. So getting a Chris Christie elected presented its own political challenges. Bob McDonnell in Virginia. This year, the storyline is a little bit more switched. Well, they're actually kind of even out. That New Jersey governor's race is going to be very interesting with some very good candidates on the Democratic side. I've had a chance to talk with Congresswoman, your colleague, Mikey Sherrill. I love her.
Me too.
running for governor.
And my dear friend, Josh Gottheimer, who is also
awesome. Right. I was going to say, right? It's a good, you know.
Good you're problem, not, Matt.
You're not going to hang your head on that. How do Democrats, in your estimation, look at going into this, not 26, but going into the fall? Is this the time where you kind of test some messaging, you kind of push and pull once the Democratic field is settled in both states with who your nominees are going to be? You sort of build around and reinforce that. Is there some thinking now about what happens in the fall?
I mean, you also have to look at the results so far in special elections since Trump. I mean, we have a track record that clearly demonstrates the rejection, near total rejection of Trump policies.
Supreme Court in Wisconsin was a big one.
Oh, it was huge. We have two blood red congressional districts that Trump won by 30 and 37 points just a few weeks ago in Florida. Yep. And the two Republicans won, which wasn't surprising. But in the panhandle, in Pensacola, you had that candidate only a 15-point margin. And in the Space Coast, where Mike Waltz used to represent, it was a 14-point margin. And the Democratic nominee won Escambia County, won Pensacola. The last time a Democrat won Pensacola was, I think, in the 80s, maybe before that. So that shows you, those are veteran-heavy, military-oriented districts. And, I mean, with what Trump is doing to our veterans, firing 6,000 veterans across the country, a third of federal employees are veterans. They are, I mean, look at what Hegseth, who is completely incompetent, is doing at DOD.
All right, so folks, we're going to take a quick break with Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, having a great conversation. We're going to have more. We're going to get into some real good politics. Hey, folks, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. Great conversation with my buddy, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida. We were talking about a lot of the dynamics of messaging, communication, the upcoming elections. In two big states for Democrats, I think this fall, New Jersey and Virginia, I think winning both of those governorships and even picking up to the extent that there are state house races, picking up a few seats, really will set the momentum that will put in place what's going to be required for Hakeem Jeffries to become the next Speaker of the House. Yes. And that politics, just for folks to know, the Congresswoman is in her congressional office. So we'll be mindful and respectful of the House rules with respect to that. But the politics of that is one thing. The execution, the ground game, the infrastructure, as a former DNC chair, is something else. How do you feel about that? And are there conversations with Chairman Martin and others in leadership about your needs in a state like Florida, already indicating, for example, the success that Democrats had in eating into two very red districts in Florida? How do you see things setting up in that regard?
Well, you can already see the momentum building. from the special election starting just after Trump's election and winning the election in November of last year. I mean, the overwhelming majority. I think we've only lost, you know, two or three special elections in races across the country where there was a partisan contest, and that's because, you know, voters, the parties are organizing, and the organizing is often tied to enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. So when you're able to cut 15, 16 points off of a congressional district outcome and win in Wisconsin a statewide race in a state that Trump won in the last election just 4 months later, that tells you that there is a dampening, to use the mildest term, of support and enthusiasm for the Republican Party because of Trump's policies and the really deep disagreement and opposition there is to what he's been doing. And at the same time, you have momentum on our side, very grassroots momentum. You can see even in some of the fundraising the successful fundraising, and the reason that those races in Florida were competitive in part was because of the purely grassroots fundraising that both candidates were able to do. But that, again, is tied back, just to bring it back to policy, right, is tied back to that, you know, the Republicans are focused on, you know, slashing Medicaid and taking nutrition benefits away from families. I mean, in Florida, we have 4 million people who are on Medicaid, 4 million people who get their health care from the Affordable Care Act. I have 110,000 folks who in my congressional district who are on Medicaid. And these are people that are in danger of their lives being jeopardized, right, by Trump's policies. And people vote based on their bottom line, you know, existential safety, security, and ability to be able to afford their basic needs. And so I think there's a real correlation along those lines.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Medicaid, Medicare narrative. When you look at the cuts that are, the only way you can do what Trump wants to do is to cut those programs along with Social Security. So that's all a lie, folks. If you think that that they're going to somehow find $880 billion just sort of lying around in the budget, defense, I don't think so. They increased defense spending. They didn't cut it. So it's going to come out of programs that impact the lives of your constituents there in Florida. You know, the constituents of the, you know, that live here in Maryland. It does raise for me when I look at your state and I go back to Tim Russert back in the day talking about the impactfulness of Florida in American politics, mm-hmm, particularly presidential politics. Florida, Florida, Florida.
It's all about Florida.
It's all about Florida. But over the last three or four cycles, you have noticed a significant shift in Florida. It was largely considered a swing state, thus Tim Russert's Florida, Florida, Florida. But that has now shifted to a more conservative-leaning storylines over the last 10 years. What in your estimation changed? Is it just demographics, more people moving into Florida with these conservative perspectives? But a lot of those folks come out of New York. So yeah. What do you see responsible for that shift? And how, with a very competitive governor's race coming up next year,
sure,
What do you see the advantages and disadvantages for Democrats going into that cycle, given the political landscape or the demographic narrative in Florida?
Well, I mean, Republicans have been in charge of state government for, you know, over 20 years, in really 25 years. And as a result, they have successfully violated our state constitution, not to gerrymander congressional districts. And so we have a 20-8 divide in our our congressional delegation.
20-8, really?
20-8, yes.
Wow. I mean,
this is not a 20-8 state. We are still, you know, we are still a state that, while not as purple as we were before, but we have a state constitutional amendment, Fair Districts Florida, that the governor violated. He actually vetoed the legislature's fair map and imposed his own that divided our delegation 20-8 instead of what it should have been, which was 16-12. And so you see through that those voter suppression efforts and then Republicans rigging the outcome of the election based on what congressional districts look like, eliminating our vote by mail ballot list, our permanent vote by mail ballot list. So voters have to sign up to request a vote by mail ballot every single election cycle now. So mm-hmm. you're having to repopulate that vote by mail, which is the primary way that Democrats are voting, as opposed to the in-person opportunities that there are. And so there's some structural issues, but clearly we have organizing that we have to rebuild, and we are in the midst of doing that. Our chair, Nikki Fried, has been very focused on that. But at the end of the day, the motivation of voters, and you see that all the way through back to, if you remember, when in the 2006 election cycle,
mm-hmm. George I remember w. it well.
Yeah, I bet you do. George W. Bush, you know, came out of that election, you know, having won in 2004, declaring some, you know, spontaneous mandate to privatize Social Security and turn Medicare into a voucher system. And you know, we successfully organized around in opposition to those principles because he never talked about that. But also, you know, like we have been talking about this afternoon, these are earned benefits. Social Security and Medicare, making sure that you can keep people healthy in their retirement year, in their senior years, when they're frail and they you know, healthcare costs go up. And protecting people's safety and security and their basic needs in retirement, that's sacred in this country. And when he came after that, Democrats won the majority in 2006 because there was a total rejection of that. And issues are really going, I mean, Trump clearly intending to slash Medicaid, make life more expensive rather than more affordable for folks, cutting in, you know, dismantling Social Security in a way that is breaking it and making it more difficult for people to get get access to their benefits. And then, which we haven't even talked about yet, their singular focus on slashing all of this spending, mm-hmm. supposedly in the name of waste, fraud, and abuse that they haven't even like been able to demonstrate exists, to make sure that they can give more tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, their millionaire and billionaire donors. That's what this boils down to. So they're trying to make room to take care of the wealthiest, most fortunate supporters of theirs.
Yeah, well, so let's unpack it a little bit, because you're right. I think it's important to dig a little bit more into what you as a member of Congress and your fellow Democrats, as well as some probably like-minded Republicans who are too skittish and afraid to really come out and stand with you in opposition to some of these things. So you've got that, how they're going to fund the government. He wants his big, beautiful bill. Mike Johnson's done everything he can to give him his big, beautiful bill, which right now is a hot mess. But then at the same time, when you have that going on, you have another story. And I'd be curious your thoughts here, because it touches on a lot of things I know you're involved in as a member of Congress. You got Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth saying on Tuesday he wants to wind down a program at the Pentagon that boosts the participation of women in peace building and conflict prevention. Donald Trump, hello, America, signed it into law. In his last administration.
Touted it as an accomplishment for women.
As an accomplishment for his agenda. But it gets even better than that.
So, but wait, there's more.
His Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, who was then a member of Congress from South Dakota, wrote the House version of the 2017 Women, Peace, and Security Act. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, former senator, championed the Senate version of the bill in the Senate. I haven't heard a peep out of one of them, Congresswoman, about this, about slashing the role of women to serve.
And Pete Hegseth, you forgot the icing on the cake. So when Pete Hegseth comes out and announces that he's ending this quote-unquote wasteful program that is part of Democrats' so-called woke ideology, and blames all of that program on Biden, I mean, completely blanks on the fact that this was a Trump initiative championed by his daughter, Ivanka Trump. I remember when she traveled around the globe promoting it. So they are liars. They fabricate the facts when the facts don't fit their narrative. And that is why people are pushing back. That is why his numbers are in the potty. It is why.
Oh, that was precious.
They are rejecting Elon Musk and his Doge bags. And it's just, it's like enough's enough. And so people are saying, we just want you, government, to focus on making our lives more affordable, which is what Democrats are going to continue to fight to make sure they know we have their back when it comes to that priority.
I have, before I let you go, Congresswoman, I do have a process question for you. And that is, you know, it's, as you can tell anyone, it's better in the majority than in the minority in the House.
I've done both ways.
You know, it just is. But are there any tools in a toolbox in a, you know, in a under a floorboard somewhere that Democrats can go to really further expose the sheer incompetency of this administration with respect to, I mean, literally the only person who's qualified to do their job, in my view, right now is Marco Rubio. Everybody else is just a freaking joke. And unfortunately for Marco, you know, his design of leadership is capitulation. So, you know, yeah, you may know how to do the job because of Senate, the work you did in the Senate, but it will matter in the job itself how you perform. What are the tools that you think are available, you know, whether legislative tools, process tools, gumming up floor votes or whatever, that can take place over the next few months, if for no other reason than to further inform and identify for the American people just how bad things will be if we continue down this road?
So we have a three-legged stool that we're focused on. We're fighting back in Congress through our legislative activity, and that includes running amendments to their vicious attacks through legislation on the American people. We're going to fight through the appropriations process when that gets started up in the next few weeks. Trump's skinny budget is being delivered on Friday. We'll have budget hearings and appropriations coming up in all 12 appropriations subcommittees. I'm a ranking member of one of those, the Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Subcommittee. So you can be sure that when Secretary Collins comes in front of our committee, we will be grilling him on the slashing that he's doing to programs that help veterans and taking and instead of improving upon what we've done for them, like in the PACT Act, that you had toxic exposed veterans who now can get health care and they are pulling back on providing that care. So we are shining a spotlight in Congress. We are running amendments and forcing votes that are difficult. We're going to make the Republicans put up or shut up. Look, are you really going to, do you come to Washington really to take away veterans' health care, to deny them benefits,
yeah,
to support a budget that fires thousands and thousands of veterans who are the backbone of the federal government's ability to take care of this country after, you know, a military career where they laid their lives down? I mean, so that's that. We're going to use procedural motions. That part of it really just slows the process down. You know, and look, we also are going to use shame because it's the tiniest margin in modern times on the House side.
Yeah,
three Republicans with a spine. Three brave Republicans to vote with us to not cut Medicaid, to not break Social Security and take away seniors' benefits, to not cut Medicaid, to not take away nutrition benefits from folks, to not cut WIC, and you know, to not take veterans' benefits away, to not fire so many people that people can't make their government work for them. So let's try some bravery. So a little shame might go a long way. You can already see Republicans on the right who are starting to, you know, wave the white flag and say, "Oh, I'm not going to stand for this." So I think it's not going to be as easy as they think to jam those bills through. And then you've got the courts, where there's been 1,200 lawsuits filed across the country, and the majority of them have had success for the plaintiffs, who are the victims of Trump's horrific policies. And then, of course, there's the community. We've got to fight side by side with our constituents, making sure that we can lend our voices to the opposition to put pressure on these MAGA extremists, that we will not stand for their horrific assault on the American people, and that we all just need to come together. Let me bring it back to being bipartisan. We could easily come together and make sure that we can make life affordable for more people. You know, it doesn't have to cost $6 for eggs in the supermarket like I go every Sunday to get. It doesn't have to be that my lunch costs $2. I can afford my lunch, the extra $2. There's a lot of people who can't. And we don't want people who are going to work and working really long hours also going without the sustenance that they need to be able to make sure that they can take care of their families. And the list goes on. So we're going to keep fighting. We're all in this together.
All right. Yes, we are. I tell my Democratic friends, we may tango on policy, but when it comes to democracy, we lock an arm in arm. And that's how we do it. She is the Congresswoman from the 25th Congressional District in the great state of Florida. She has been for a great deal of time a strong advocate for women, their rights, their service to our country, protecting the civil rights, the medical rights, healthcare rights of the American people. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman. Pardon me?
Thank you for your voice, Michael.
Oh, I'm just a brother in the neighborhood.
You're amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman. Our time together now, folks. Remember to do the download thing. You know how much I love it when you do. It makes me feel all yummy inside. And remember, one other thing, as you embrace this platform and you listen and you learn, please stay away from stupid. All right? Just don't play with stupid, because it makes you do stupid things. Take care. See y'all later.
Take care.